Welcome to Portia Pattern with Bracken Helms, the show where we hear Bracken and his distinguished guests from the Portia community patter on about Porsches and all things automotive. Portia Pattern is sponsored by Circuit 64. Circuit 64 creates authentic automotive apparel made for like-minded automotive enthusiasts. The links for Circuit 64 are in the show notes. Okay, let's get to it.
Tony Kallas, part 5. All right, you knew I was going to go into that Monza car and the story behind it. One of the stories about Porsche that I find most exciting is that Monza car, that 911R. I mean, the fact that they were breaking a record. They weren't just doing it for themselves. They were breaking a record for reliability and endurance. So they take the 906, they're driving it, and they're trying to break this record. The track is just so in disrepair, or it's got potholes and it's just not ideal, that it just is breaking the suspension on the 906, crashing over like potholes and stuff. Anyway, so it's like destroying the suspension is how I remember it. So they have like, I don't remember, there's like X amount of time that they have to pause until it has to start over again. So they call and like, okay, well, we can send the 911R in. As I recall, they didn't ship the 911R. He got in the car and drove it to the track, then started racing. And the track, it's not like the 911R showed up and all of a sudden the track became better. You're dealing with a crappy track that's like busted the suspension on the 906, and the 911R has got to do the same thing. And the fact that it like breaks the record and just hums around that track, and then to find out that the engine was already used. They didn't show up like, we've been planning this for months and we've got this dialed engine in and everything was blueprinted and everything was perfect. No, they were in a hurry. They took it off the shelf. They brought the car over. The car already had plenty of time on it, but you know, he says 100 hours. 100 hours. So they just showed up in like a well-used car. They drive it there. They drive around the track. There's zero issues, and the track is less than ideal. It already destroyed one of their race cars. I love that story. Anyway, here's part 5 of Tony Kallas.
You don't like the idea of being a shop for everybody. You want to select clientele.
Okay, so in the end, this has changed because we have to be around. But for the first 25 years of this company, I didn't just want everybody or anybody. And I set a rule, and people have been blown away by this rule forever. To become a customer, you have to go through a first time in checkover with us. And it took 1 hour, 2 hours. Now it's 4 hours, where we check over your car while you wait and we show you everything wrong. And the reason is you have to realize this was pre-computer. I got so upset at customers for not taking care of their car properly, and they didn't deserve the car. So like when Mike's got a pretty good story that you should talk to him about eventually, the first time he came to the shop, he went through that checkover. I didn't have a rule at the time of that you had to wait around, but when you come in, I show you the list, preferably not in scribble, but in good print or typed up. But that rule of the first time in, the FTIC, the Kallas Rennsport first time in checkover, really blew people away. And it mostly became a problem with entertainers and their managers because nobody wanted to come here. And I'm like, sorry, you don't need to bring your car here. Find somebody else. And it blew people's minds that were some of the most famous actors and actresses were like, you don't want me to bring my car in if I can't be there? I'm like, no, sorry. You don't have to be here. Bring your manager, just somebody. It did something for the company. It was really interesting. But I'm going to tell you something right now that's going to sound wrong. You make something unique and you make it special and you tell people they can't have it and they do nothing but want it. You know, we have to look back at what we're dealing with here. We have a $20,000, $30,000 car that's now $100,000 or $60,000 and up. And you still have the AC system of a 1980 or 85 911. You still have the lack of creature comforts and no ventilation unless you try to, you know, God forbid you had wind wings, which I loved. But people are buying these cars for a lot of money now and they're expecting more out of them. And it's not that car. This is an old Porsche.
So which cars did you work on as a child? You said you worked on race cars with your dad. Like what? Which one?
Well, my dad had a 910. I mean, I can tell you stories. I mean, when I sat in that car for the first time and I'm looking at the pedals and my legs were halfway to the pedals and I'm like, I'll never reach these pedals. How is this possible? I'll never get tall enough. Now, I'm not that tall, but you got to realize, and I stood behind the race car when he started up. I mean, literally 3 feet from the megaphones and he revs it up and I'm just in ecstasy because of how beautiful the engine sounds and the smell of the visceral, you know, effect of that car. I don't know anything different than the RSRs and the 910s and the early 911s. I mean, my father was unique. He was different in that period of time in 1972 when we lived in Austin at the bottom of a hill and it froze and it was all icy. My father was the only one that could make it to work in an early 911S. I mean, you'd hear him going up the hill. You know, the sound of a 911 with that early muffler. I'm used to just so many different things. I was also a little pyromaniac though, so go ahead.
Okay. Which race cars do you mostly work on now, or like which ones are your favorites?
Porsches have always been a special place in my heart, the GT1 and the GT2s, the 993 GT2s, etc. And you have to realize how close the GT1 is to the 956 and the 962. But now I have a motorsport business, so I don't mean to sound like it doesn't matter, but almost I take a customer. And whether it's a Toyota or whether, you know, which is BMW in this respect, or a BMW, or whether it's an Aston Martin, that's our business. That's what we do. When it comes to my favorites, I love the new GT3 Cup car.
You guys don't use air tools, correct?
So, no, we don't. Because for me, you have to realize a Porsche has a lot of aluminum components. And also, there's a lot of tactile feedback. That's why I don't believe in these gloves that a lot of mechanics wear. You don't feel things. And when you're using an air tool, first of all, it's difficult for me to have that much noise around me. I mean, racing is different, but for me to work on something, I think it comes with having, I'm not saying I'm on the spectrum, but there's something going on there where the noise just bothers me. And it really affects me. And Adrian didn't really do it. I mean, sure, there are certain situations when you'll do it. But in the end, if you're taking a nut off of a stud, or you're taking a bolt out, or you're taking a spark plug out, you need to feel every turn and everything that you're doing. And is there a problem? And be alert, be aware, have a situational awareness. But that tactile feedback is what I like. And you don't get that with an air tool. We all have our issues and idiosyncrasies and things we may like or not like. But to me, doing something properly includes feeling and being there and paying attention to what you're doing.
So you're one of two authorized shops to work on the 959 in the US.
Incorrect.
Okay.
So authorized is really tough. Porsche authorizes nobody other than their dealers because the dealers pay for that franchise. Bruce in Scotts Valley or us, neither of us are authorized. Have I spent a lot of time at the factory? Yes. Did I buy all the factory tools for the Porsche 959? Yes. Have I spent over 20 years on these cars? Absolutely. So I have to straighten that up. Sure, I'd love to hear that we're factory authorized, but nobody is, except for the dealer, and they don't know how to work on these cars. We are just the shop that have put the most effort and time into servicing the 959s, learning about all of their pattern failures and their issues, and spent the money on the tools. We have the wheel bearing tools for the rear wheel bearings, et cetera. So paid our dues.
So how did that come about? And how did you get specified, like, or you kind of got known for 959 and kind of like 911R?
Well, I hate to give you that information, but basically there's nothing to it other than me saying, hey, I want to become Porsche Motorsport in the U.S. or I want to become the 959 place in the U.S. That's what it is. It's desire, effort, and how hard you want to work to get there. And in 1998 or 2000, I'd said that. And that's what I wanted to become. So all it took in the end was to get one and then to show you can do it. You're not going to get paid very well in the beginning. You know, it's just like developing a race engine. It's going to be obscenely expensive in the beginning. But for us, we didn't make much. But once we put our name and got our name out there and proved that we could do this, and a lot of good clients, right? That's what matters.
you believe in keeping the 959 stock.
There's no question.
Is there anything done to bring it up to snuff or whatever? Because Canepa, I don't know if this is true, Canepa wasn't planning on modifying his, but after the missions and all that stuff, he felt it was low on horsepower. And again, I don't know if that's accurate, but I'm just wondering, like...
Have you talked to him?
No.
Okay.
I've talked to Sean.
This is
what not I've, about 959s.
This is what I've heard also, like what you said. But you have to realize when you come from my background of being a purist and seeing how Porsche put that car out, you realize how much that car cost in the beginning and that they lost money on it. And that, as I heard Lori Schutz say the other day when we spoke together at an event, nobody looks at the cost if something's very successful or if you win this race and nobody looks at the cost. But in the end, that they looked at the cost of that car and it was crazy. For me, I'm not saying that everything Porsche puts out is great. I'll put hydraulic chain tensioners on an SC, but a lot of things that we do can be reversed easily. I believe in my heart that that car is wonderful the way it came out. If you get one that's operating properly, the brakes are operating properly, the pedal effort to stopping distance feels good, the suspension system is operating on all three levels, and you go into different levels for surface, whether it's rain or whatnot, that car is amazing. So that's what I would say. No reason to modify it. I'm not saying Bruce did something wrong. That's right. His prerogative, right? It's yin or yang, with us, right? Click and clack. Point and counterpoint. Bruce and I are the two people in the country, and he does it one way and I do it another, and that's what keeps us talking. Otherwise, him and I are both so competitive, I don't think it would work for us to get in the same room together.
Okay, your thoughts on modern tires on like a 959 or a Carrera GT? Because first thought is, oh, well, obviously it's going to be groundbreaking. It's going to have modern rubber on it. But the way they were set up, is the modern rubber going to kind of... the engineers obviously set it up for the way the tires are going to react. If the tires are so much greater, is that going to like throw the balance off?
Well, I'm not a huge proponent of N-spec tires that Porsche sells. But you're talking to somebody who just took a 68 911R around Laguna Seca with 1968 tires. There's a little excitement involved there too. But let's get down to reality. Aside from that, I am a Denlock fan, and I think those tires belong on those wheels on the 959. So saying that I don't care for N-spec tires, which Porsche puts out, there's probably more of an education that's needed there. But I do think Denlocks belong on 959s, and you should replace tires on a Carrera GT every 4 years.
What publications have you written for besides 000? Excellent. And then you've written in Panorama.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's many. I like writing white papers.
Yeah.
And explaining systems because of the training I've done. I don't remember some of the others. I work very closely with Randy Leffingwell. So I guess you could call that a ghostwriter. But 000 is awesome. The problem is I'm a technical writer and Pete kind of likes a different style. So if I really wanted to work on it, Tom and I, my writing partner, we could maybe do something. Excellence was a good run. We did it for almost 10 years. Panorama is the biggest right now because I answered technical questions.
Okay.
And I enjoy that. I enjoy answering technical questions. And it's the thing I enjoy the most. And it's for free. It's volunteer. And so it's kind of odd. We can go into money later on, what really matters and what doesn't. What we enjoy.
Okay, let's see. How do I, my dad's a Porsche broker. He's been around these cars for a while. It's his belief that sometimes, like when you either totally restore a car or you start messing with that hot rod, not necessarily just the hot rod things of modifying it, but sometimes when you tear into the car a little bit, you lose that soul.
So here's what I can tell you, and this comes from being an engine builder. You can build an engine with a lot of horsepower, but you have to realize this is a scale. You have to balance this out. Do you want a lot of horsepower and the thing to not last very long? Or do you want less horsepower and it to last a medium amount? Look at any aircraft engine. They actually have calculations to where if that engine runs at 180 degrees and all the time and it does this, it will last the longest. Where you can maybe run it hotter and faster and it won't last as long. For me, I would rather build it stock I build a lot of unique engines. Somebody said to me the other day, oh, you haven't built many of the special race engines or anything. Oh, yeah. I built 3-2 Carrera engines that I call little gorillas. And they have extrude hone intakes, matched intakes to the heads, ported heads. And you know what? We don't do all of that work alone. I've kind of been the chef in putting that recipe together, along with the exhaust. And the cams are a very important part of it, and the chip that I use Steve Wong for. But to me, it's hard to outdo what Porsche's done without taking away certain aspects. You know what a lot of people do? They'll tune a car. They'll give it these performance mods, but it doesn't run very good on the street when it's first started. I mean, or even when it's warmed up, it doesn't have drivability. And you have to add drivability as a very important part of this rebuild process, modifications.
How did you get involved with the 911R at Monza?
You mean to restore the car?
Yeah.
That went to Monza? Because Monza was, you know, 67. The client reached out, was going to go to Porsche to restore the car. There are certain things that you have to look at what Porsche does and what we do. I did not have the most experience on 911Rs, and nobody did until around that period of time when a gentleman bought three of them. It's mostly about looking at the most of the R's that you can and deduce what's real and what belongs on them. And then there's historians. Brad Davis, a good friend of mine, is a historian. It's again, just like the 959. Hey, I want to be the one to know the most about the R's. So I researched and studied and flew here and flew there and looked at different cars, went to Europe, spent time at the factory, and the factory actually got to the point where they asked me not to write the book on the car because they were afraid people were going to build a fake R.
So that car, when it broke the record, that engine was already well used, right?
That engine had 100 hours on it already when Porsche was going to run that record run with a 906, a Carrera 6, and four Swiss drivers. The car was red.
Right.
And so when the suspension broke on that car, they brought three R's from the factory. They pulled an engine off the shelf. I think it was out of number two and put it in number one. It had 100 hours on it already, and they just ran it. What does that say about Porsche, about the strength of the 911 flat six engine?
Yeah. How long were you working with that car before you realized the stripes were the wrong color?
That was starting to happen immediately. Between Tom Prine and Mike Harmon, and there's a few other people that were involved, we researched, and Randy Leffingwell was the one that got the answer through a guy from the factory, and he came up with photos. And when we first took that car to the Quail Classic, being red instead of green, everybody came up and thought we did the worst thing ever. How could we change the color of that car? Peter Falk drove this car from Porsche to Monza. He even remembered it being green until he found the photos. There are people out there with a name and a history that said that they flaked paint off the car and remember it being green. I mean, everybody came up to us at the Quail Classic when the car was red and just said, how could you do this? This is a disgrace. And then I showed them the photo album and everybody was just shocked, because you have to realize you can't see that Pantone when it's black and white. You don't know if that's green or red. And when we got the red photos, it was a mind blower for the Porsche world.
It's weird that you brought up Malcolm Gladwell, because he does a podcast that's like an hour long, and it's specifically that exact same thing. People saying, I remember it this way. That's the way it was. We got many people back, and then they do the research, and it's like people's memory just adapt to it, or I don't know.
There's a couple of sayings that I have that I teach. One is, we don't like what we're not familiar with. We're just not used to it. And the second thing is, most people are followers, and that's what we're talking about here. And they're just like, yeah, rah, 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 you know. It's like back, it reminds me of the day when they're hanging somebody and people are standing in the square going, yeah, do it, you know. And we're pretty rough.
Yeah, that's not really a road I want to go down. But like, I was, when you said that, it reminded me, like, yeah, they used to do it like after church. But they bring like after church, yeah. Like it was an event, and they would like have their kids there, like,
yeah, you know what? We've changed a lot. We've grown a lot. We've evolved. So, yeah, I really find it interesting to analyze human nature and what we do and what we don't like. And I did it with myself. A new car came out, and I'm like, oh, I don't like this. Well, why don't I like this? But you don't realize that when you're younger. You have an idealistic view of the world. And I just spent time the other day in Houston with this. It's a relative, and she is, like, brilliant. But you also see the young age in her, and I'd love to see the world through her eyes, but everything is black and white. It's not black and white, it's gray. And we have to realize that we all have something to learn here. So carry on.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, comment, like, and share with your friends. Feel free to send questions or suggestions to the email in the description of the show. Special thanks to our sponsor, Circuit 64. Goodbye for now. We hope we can get together again for our next episode. Now get out there and enjoy the cars and the people.